It's the Dummies edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, an interview with Dale McGowan, author of Atheism for Dummies. Let's begin episode 230.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, listeners. This week's rant is on spying. With yet more revelations from Snowden on the spying activity of agencies such as the NSA and Canada's own CSEC, that stands for Communication Security Establishment of Canada, well, what has made these releases different from before is the amount of spying that is perpetuated on our allies. The U.S. has been tapping the phones of, among others, German Chancellor Merkel and Mexican President Calderon, and that this spying has been going on prior to them becoming actually state leaders. Merkel was put on the spy list in 2002, apparently from some sources I have, because Germany refused to join the U.S. in the Iraq War. It has come to light that Canada was spying on the President of Brazil and the Ministry of Mining and Energy. What has set this apart from other spying is its intended purpose. It has become common refrain that this level of spying is necessary to stop terrorist attacks, but that the evidence has been increasingly pointing that much of the spying isn't for the state, but for national corporations. The spying on the Brazil Ministry of Mining and Energy is now thought to be done to give a leg up to Canadian-based mining and petroleum options. I doubt there are a lot of terrorists that are actually working in the Brazil Mining and Energy Ministry. Now, you might, and I must stress, might, be able to get me to go along with the spy in every laptop if the purpose was to stop crime and terrorism, whatever that means now. But when the current security apparatus of the state is given to private, for-profit corporations who have little to no interest in the reputation of the nation, well, that just leaves me dumbstruck. I wonder if we charge them for the information. If we're spying for the corporate interest, doesn't that take them away from the job of keeping the nation safe? So in the first place, it strikes me as wrong that we are expending not only valuable public resources to enable private corporations to make better deals because they know what the other side is talking about, but it also sullies the reputation of the nation. Canada is known as a nice guy, or well, it was. The concentrated efforts of the current regime under Harper has tarnished our name so much so that Canadian travelers are now sewing New Zealand flags on their backpacks for fear of being discovered to be Canucks. Now, I was talking to a loyal listener of Radio Free Thinker, and they mentioned that we should be appalled that we are spying at all on our allies, that there should be some kind of Marquis de Queensborough rules for spying. Well, we all kind of agree on the basic ground rules, but that doesn't stop, you know, how do I put this? You know, there should be some basic ground rules, such as you don't spy on your friends, and if you do, they may choose not to be your friends anymore. Now, in principle, I agree with the sentiment, and since the whistleblower Snowden's revelations, many nations now are talking about an international treaty regulating spying. However, into this mix, I was listening to one of the many podcasts I listen to each week. On it, I heard a very Machiavellian and cold response to the idea of playing nice. He said, deadpan and matter of fact, well, if one nation is spying for economic advantage and your nation is not, well, that puts you at a strategic disadvantage. You lose. In isolation, we could say, well, no, decent nations do not give up integrity for monetary gains, at least in the short term. Now, the depth of the spying that Snowden has revealed has relevance in an unexpected way. He has shown that the NSA, among others, are not spying to protect the nation or weed out crime. Their motivation seems to be just to get it all. If there is a system, a place, or a person that seems beyond their spy network, they make every effort to crack it and put it into their spy network. Merkel was famous for her use of conducting politics via her phone. This fact alone seems to have made her a target of the NSA. It's not, do I need to spy on her, but can I spy on her? Once this threshold has been reached, once nations know that the U.S. is willing to stoop lower than anyone else, the argument made about, do you want to handicap your side by not spying, makes it a race to the bottom of ethical spying. I want Canada to take the high road. I think in the long run, that way prosperity lies. But I understand all too well the pull of the dark side. With our current leadership, I have no doubts that we are not taking the high road. We return after this break with my interview with Dale McGowan, author of Atheism for Dummies.
Zines, magazines, books, art, crafts, readings, performances, lectures. Do you like these things?
Yeah.
Do you like when these things are made by indie artists in your community?
Yeah.
Then come on down to Canzine West, the greatest festival of zine and independent culture, brought to you by Broken Pencil Magazine, on Saturday, November 2nd from 1 to 7 p.m. at the Ukrainian Hall at 805 Pender Street East.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining. That's what friends are for.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, listeners. In our virtual Radio Freethinker studio today, we have Dale McGowan, author of Atheism for Dummies. Welcome to Radio Freethinker, Dale.
Good to be here, Don. Thanks.
So, I was thinking about the title of your book, Atheism for Dummies. On the one hand, like all of the dummy series of books, it's intended to inform people about a subject they might be interested in. However, another reading could imply that possible target audience are theists, and you just called them dummies. Now, I doubt that was your intent, but let's start by asking, who did you write this book for?
Yeah, it's a good question. The title, first of all, is non-negotiable with the series, the Dummies series. There are 1,600 books, and they approached me to write it, and the title was, you know, already going to be set at that point. So it's always sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing, you know, for people who sort of have a sense of humor about that sort of thing. And they wanted the book to be written for the layperson, written for somebody who doesn't know that much about atheism but is interested in learning more. A lot of times that'll be, you know, maybe somebody whose relative is an atheist or something, and they might be a believer themselves. I think in most cases the audience is going to be. But they are they're comfortable enough in their own skin to dig into a book like this and find out. So my idea was to make the threshold nice and low for them. It's not a book that's set up to convince anybody of anything. It's describing atheism. It's talking about atheist history and atheist thought, humanism, and so on. That's the primary audience. But I had a secondary audience in mind, which is atheists. I have yet to come across an atheist who has read the book who didn't say that they learned a lot from it that they didn't know before. I learned a ton while I was doing the research. So that's been kind of a nice secondary audience, is the people who've been atheists for 10 or 20 years and still found out a lot about atheism from the book.
And I think one of the things that I know when I read the book that I thought this sort of the same idea, and that, you know, it's part of the atheist mentality sometimes is to do that, you know, discovering more, to find out more. That's almost one of the foundations of atheism, which I think leads to the next question. So what is atheism?
Well, atheism is really the simple assertion. Actually, there are two ways you can go with it. It is either the passive definition, which is a lack of belief in gods. And that's not really a terribly useful definition. By that definition, you know, a newborn baby or a ham sandwich are atheists. But the strong atheism is more of an assertion. It's somebody who's not, you're not necessarily saying, I am certain, but you're saying, I am of the opinion that no gods exist. That's an atheist. And I find that a little more meaningful. I was technically an atheist when I was 3 years old, but I achieved something in coming to my atheism later on and being able to assert it positively, you know, being able to say this is what I believe is true. And I think that's a different kind of definition and a more useful one.
How would you distinguish atheist then from an agnostic?
There's a tremendous amount of overlap. They're emphasizing two different things. Atheism is an assertion, and agnosticism is the recognition that just as in anything that is evidence-based and science-based, there's always an element of doubt. I think there's about as much doubt of the existence of God as there is of Vishnu or Zeus or any other. I'm willing to say that I'm an agnostic and an atheist. I think it's a misconception a lot of people have that atheists are saying, are making a statement of certainty. I think most atheists don't do that. They say, like Dawkins says on the 7-point scale, you know, where 7 is absolute certainty. He even says that he's a 6. So it's really, I think, it's a richer understanding of the terms to say I'm an atheist because that's my opinion, and I'm an agnostic because I recognize that none of us know for certain about this, but we can make a strong, confident assertion.
Now, some people refer to atheism as a religion, others a philosophy. So what are your views on this?
Calling it a religion is fine. If somebody wants to completely mangle the definition of religion, they can call it that. But it really doesn't fit any of the traditional definitions of religion. Religion is typically doing something else. It is typically includes the belief in some sort of supernatural being or beings, and atheism doesn't have that. So it's a worldview. I think atheism can be the first step in creating a philosophy, but I wouldn't call it a philosophy in and of itself. I'd say you start with that simple assertion, I don't think that there are gods. Well, then what do you think? And that is naturalism, that is, you know, the eventually humanism, which is sort of the ethical system that's built around it. So I think it's just, it's good to just call atheism the assertion that kicks things off, and then a lot of things come from that when you try to fill in the void that's left by this, all the supernatural stuff that's been removed.
And so you see there's an evolution from atheism to something like humanism.
Oh, absolutely. I think most of the atheists I know would also say that they are humanists, meaning once you take God away, you say, okay, well, then it's up to us to make the kind of world we want to make. It's up to us to take care of each other. We don't have anybody to pray to. We don't have any ultimate authority to appeal to. And humanism is everything that flows from that. I've said that atheism is the first step, and humanism is 1,000 steps that follow. That's the answering of all the cavalcade of questions that come pouring out after you get rid of the supernatural idea.
So if atheism is the first step, when did atheism first develop?
Well, it's a good question, and it's as fuzzy as the question, when did religion first develop? My guess is that The first evidence of religion is 130,000 years ago in burials with apparently intentionally placed flowers in the burial and that sort of thing. And my guess is that pretty much as far back as there has been religion, there's been some guy in the back of the room shaking his head and saying this is all BS. I mean, it just seems likely. My guess is that it was really a very uncommon thing. Because honestly, if you put yourself in the Stone Age, here you've got this fully modern anatomy, fully modern human mind, capable of understanding the world, but no answers to plug into it. We did not know how anything happened. And so I think religion is a completely understandable response to that kind of a world. You have got to say, well, it just doesn't feel safe to say, I don't know, you know, what causes people to die or what happens after we die. So they start filling it with answers in the absence of anything else. And I think it would be the rare person at that point who would be able to confidently say, well, that's BS, you know, I'm not going to buy that. But at some point, you know that these people were there. At some point, the confidence and the, you know, the human development kicked in. We know for a fact that they were there in ancient Judea. That's the first time we start to really get a record of it. And the record we get is from the Bible. You know, in Psalms 14, verse 1, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Well, that's the psalmist testifying to the fact that there was somebody there saying there was no God. You know, yeah. So we get these sort of indirect evidences of the existence of atheists as far back as Old Testament times. And then certainly in ancient Greece and Rome, it began to cohere into several schools of thought.
Do you hold to the idea that that religion is somehow an evolutionary advantage, or was at some point, or is it more epiphenomenal? As you sort of said, it's sort of an after part of our inquisitive mind.
Yeah, I think that's I think it's a really good question, and I can see a strong argument for either going either direction. It actually, in the same way that positive thinking is helpful for, you know, healing, that there's nothing magical going on there, but that they know that, you know, if you have a terminal illness or something like this, keeping a positive attitude is something that actually ends up making a difference how your body is able to defend. So there are ways you can think of an actual practical advantage. But the psychological advantage would be huge. It would be absolutely enormous. And I'd have to think that that would be the sort of thing that might have been helpful in the very marginal lives that we lived in the Paleolithic, for example. And that a lot of people still live. And to have that in the absence of other answers, to be able to say, that's okay. I don't know what on earth is going on, but there is this thing out there that is all-knowing and all-good and omnipresent and loves me to death. Not to death.
Hopefully not. Actually, no, loves you after death as
loves
well.
You after death, right. And I can see that there would be a tremendous advantage in the same way, that would sort of give you the confidence to move forward in the absence of other answers. Of course, now we have other answers. But a lot of people don't have access to it, or they're not willing to look at those answers because they've fallen so much in love with the other possibility.
Well, and that leads to the next thing. So we sort of have in these sort of ancient times, atheism sort of forming. But, I mean, it's changed a lot. One, the idea of atheism and our knowledge of the universe. So how has atheism evolved over time?
Oh, yeah, I think knowledge is the thing that has led the evolution of atheism. I honestly, if I think of myself in the 12th century or something like this, I just doubt very much that I would have been an atheist. I wouldn't have had the information. You know, I wouldn't have had the ability to assert that. It would have been fairly obvious to me that God exists. But once you get the scientific revolution kicking in, once you get the human ability to actually explain things in a systematic way and in a reliable way, and then you start to get things like heliocentrism, you start to get evolution in the 19th century. There's a reason that's at the center of the culture war. Evolution is the thing that Dawkins, I think, said evolution by natural selection made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. It was possible to be an atheist before that, but there were still all these sort of nagging questions about how things get put together, and wham, natural selection fills in those gaps. And then you're able to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So over time, all through the centuries, especially with the scientific revolution, everything that came after that, there starts to be more of a foundation under the feet of an atheist. And now, honestly, it's fairly easy, I think, to come to atheistic conclusions. It's not terribly difficult. But 500 years ago, I think it was nearly impossible. It certainly would have been impossible for me. I'm amazed that anyone managed it.
We've talked on the show a number of times about, you know, to be a, quote, true atheist, one must first be a skeptic, like scientific skeptic, that a belief, that disbelief founded on, not founded on rational thought is not really any better than a belief founded similarly. So what do you think the relationship is then between atheism and skepticism? Is it, you know, chicken and the egg sort of thing, or?
Oh, no, I do think that it flows from skepticism. I think skepticism comes first, because religion is really what most of us are handed first. That's the assumption that we're handed as kids. And so what you have to do is develop a skeptical attitude about what you've been handed. And that requires the hardest thing for a person to do, which is to step away from your confirmation bias. There are all sorts of nasty things about the God of the Bible, but the general idea of this supernatural being who loves you and cares for you and gives you a place to walk around after you're dead, that appeals to us as human beings very deeply. And to be willing to love the truth enough to step aside from that confirmation bias and go after these answers requires skepticism first and foremost. And then it falls away pretty quickly. It certainly did for me, and I think for most people, you know, it isn't a matter of sort of wrestling with these ideas. Once you're willing to ask the questions directly, which means you've developed that skeptical framework, then it takes care of itself pretty neatly.
One of the things that's been an issue with atheism and skepticism more in particular is there's sort of a division in the community. So, for example, someone like Bill Maher is an atheist, but I wouldn't call him a great skeptic. And Sam Harris, as much as he's done some great work, sometimes comes across as a bit of an Islamophobic or sort of racist. What do you think about these sort of divides? I mean, should atheists embrace all atheists equally, or how much should we sort of police our own?
Oh, yeah, gosh. We certainly shouldn't embrace someone simply because they're an atheist. That way lies madness. I mean, then you're embracing Stalin and all sorts of, you know, nasty things. But that goes back to the skepticism again. We've got to apply skepticism to each other just in exactly the way that we do to the rest of the world. And I actually think it's a very, very good sign that we've got the divisions that we've got in the movement. It's difficult. It's painful. But that's a sign of skepticism. It's a sign that we're not willing to just overlook anything in order to move forward as a unit. We're willing to say, hey, no, this matters. You know, vaccinations, if you're talking about vaccinations as if this is, you know, some sort of an open question in the scientific community, that's not all right. I don't care if you're an atheist or not. So I'm really fine with the divisions. The only thing that I occasionally get frustrated with is when people misrepresent or oversimplify someone on the other side of the fence. Even within atheism, I hear it all the time. So our desire is to be skeptical, but sometimes we fall short of that, and we get into our own patterns of, again, confirmation bias and all sorts of other things that make us argue nonsensically and defensively and so on. So we have to approach the things that we do with sometimes a little more humility than we do. Sometimes I think we come at it with an absolute assertion that the person on the other side of the fence is an obvious moron and the other person's doing the same, and then it goes nowhere. If each person was saying, this is my position, I hold it very strongly, and I could be wrong, if we just added that, at least implicitly, at the end of the things that we say, it's amazing how much easier it is to move forward.
Do you think there are sort of bounds to the idea of skepticism? I mean, Sam Harris has his book, The Moral Landscape, mm-hmm. and again, some of the divides in skepticism is, you know, should we apply skepticism to economics or social issues or something like that? What do you think about this idea of, you know, science is maybe ultimately answering all questions?
Oh, well, if you really think of science and skepticism as simply getting away from that confirmation bias. If you just define it in that way, and if you look at the scientific revolution, that's what every single aspect of the revolution was about. It was about looking at flawed human beings and the way we reason poorly and trying to control that bias. That's the way science is set up. Scientists, individual scientists, for example, are no more or less likely to have biases than anybody else. But science as an enterprise and the idea of peer review is the thing that keeps checks and balances among those various biases. So, and I knew I was going to wander and forget your question. Remind me what you...
The idea that can science answer all the questions?
Oh, right.
You know, the idea of Harris's moral landscape, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think science properly understood, if you understand it as a skeptical approach that tries to suspend bias, I think there's no reason that it can't get into just about any inquiry. And certainly the area that Harris gets into in the moral landscape is entirely within the bounds of science. I think he makes a very credible argument that morality is completely comprehensible in terms of in human behavior. And if something is comprehensible, if it's observable, if it's testable, then skepticism is the appropriate tool to bring to it.
I always find it interesting that one of the criticisms theists often have is the fact that science always is changing, so there's no like absolute truth.
I know. Isn't that incredible? That's amazing. Yeah.
So today we have sort of this new sense of atheism as an identity. You talk in your book about atheism as a cultural movement. If atheism is at its heart a lack of belief, how can it be the source of identity any more than I'm not a baseball fan could be a source of my identity?
Yeah, that's a common analogy. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson recently made a similar analogy with not liking golf. I think it is something like that. If I lived in a culture in which basketball defined my life and found its way into my government and controlled people's actions and inspired people to violence and so on, then I actually think being opposed to basketball could indeed be an identity, because what you're then opposing is all the outcomes of basketball as well. But in fact, basketball isn't that, but religion is. You know, so if you say, I'm starting with this defining myself by this lack of belief, first of all, if most of the people around you have that belief, then it really is meaningful to say I'm somebody who is elsewhere. I'm someone who is not embracing that. Secondly, you're saying I'm opposed to the what I see as the negative outcomes of that belief. That's one of the things that defines me. And then finally, what happens with the assertion of atheism is, again, there are next steps. There are things that fill in the gap. So it's never, I don't know anyone who's just an atheist. You know, there's always something that comes behind it and fills it in. You've made that assertion, I don't believe in God. Well, what do you think is true? And then you find out it's naturalism. And you say, well, how do you think people should behave? And then you talk about naturalistic ethics. And all these things fill in the gaps. And that really does create a meaningful identity.
I find it kind of interesting that one analogy I sometimes think of is anarchists, you know, who don't believe in government, but you wouldn't quite say that they don't have any identity or beliefs.
Oh, that's a perfect example. That's very good, yeah.
Now, I've described myself as a fundamentalist evangelical atheist. I use the word fundamentalist in that, perhaps uniquely, that I think the concept of God rests on the idea of supernatural, which I think is contradictory to reality. I mean, almost by definition, nothing supernatural can exist in a natural universe.
Right.
Even if you sort of reject my rejection of supernatural, classic religions still fail to make the grade. I also tend to use the word evangelical because, for me at least, it's not good enough to just disbelief. I want to actively resist religion and deconvert as many people as I can. Now, on the show, we've also promoted the idea of something what I call full-spectrum atheism, that we need sort of the loud and in-your-face atheists like Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, but we also need moderates like Neil deGrasse Tyson and even some accommodationalists who kind of help ease the transition from theism to atheism. What do you think of this description, and what kind of an atheist would you describe yourself?
Yeah, I think the whole idea of the full spectrum is always really interesting, and I think it was a sort of promising evolution in the discussion once people started to say that, because really it hasn't been that long ago, 10 years ago or something, that people were saying, no, we don't need the full spectrum. We all need to be very aggressive, very militant. And the only problem I have with the spectrum is that, again, a lot of times people in the various parts of the spectrum characterize the others in a way that's inaccurate. One of the things that many people who are on the accommodationist end will say that the more aggressive atheists don't discern between religious expressions. Well, I actually know a lot of very aggressive, very activist atheists who do discern between the progressive and the regressive expressions of atheism. And then the other side is when people look at, you know, we're typically called accommodationists and say, well, they think all religion is fine. I don't know any accommodationists who think all religion is fine or want to just want to get along with people. They are also discerning among the various shades of religion and choosing to emphasize the common ground and to build bridges and so on. So I do think they all have a contribution to make. For myself, I have actually evolved over the course of my own activism. I've been an atheist for certainly 30 years. And early on, I was more aggressive. I was more engaged in that kind of intellectual discourse. And I was always asking the question, why can't they see this? You know, why can't they see this? Why aren't they willing to see the evidence that's right before their eyes? And I began to take that as a less rhetorical question. I began to say, why can't they see it? What's actually going on in them that makes them unwilling to see this thing that to me is so obvious and clear? And I became very interested in the psychology of belief and realizing that throwing yet another argument against the existence of God, throwing yet another criticism of the Bible and so on in front of somebody, if they are not willing to cross that threshold, it will do absolutely no good. This is the reason we pile all our arguments up, and all it does for a lot of people is make them more defensive. It causes them to retreat into their religion. So what I have actually begun doing in the last, certainly in the last 7 or 8 years, I am trying to create a viable humanism as a community that's an attractive option for people. Because if people feel that they don't have any place else to go for their social connections, for their feeling of community and connectedness to others and being taken care of, that's what religion is for so many people. And what we need to do is create a secular option for that, where people can feel that same sense of warmth and community and emotion and connectedness that they feel with religion. And that's a different approach. It's a lot of the people who are involved in that are just as interested in deconverting people, just as interested, but they're taking a different approach. They're taking the approach that it's better to not get people's defenses up and instead create a positive alternative for them so that they will come over. And I have had much more sense of success in this. I've had many, many more people communicate to me that my work and my writing and my speaking has influenced them to leave their religion and leave their churches since I've adopted this approach. Instead of attacking where they are, instead build this positive alternative for them.
I think one of the areas where I think the loud and sort of the obnoxious atheist has point, I don't think that I'm going to convert too many people, because I do tend to get a bit full of myself at times, and I try and pull back a bit. But it provides pushback against, you know, theists who are just as loud and obnoxious and that sort of thing. And it starts the conversation. It gives people like you, who is much more likely to reach people, a reason to say, hey, well, let me tell you what it's really about, and, you know, to create the space for the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that Dave Silverman with American Atheists has also said, exactly that. There's a synergy between the voices. It's not even just reaching different people, but two different ones, one of them sort of opening the discussion and the other one continuing it. I think that's true.
There's been a growing movement of what they call atheist churches, or perhaps a better label is the Sunday Assembly. What are your thoughts on this growing movement?
Well, I think it's a really good thing because it's creating options for people. And it's not the sort of thing that I'm looking for. It's not the sort of thing that I think a lot of people who are currently in the free thought movement are looking for, but that's why we're in it. You know, that's why we were able to walk away from church so relatively easily, because we didn't need that social thing. But there are an awful lot of people, many more people, I think, who are, some of them still going to church, some of them not going to church, some of them still believers and some not, but who really hunger for this social connection. There's been some good sociology done on this recently, this idea. There's a Harvard and University of Wisconsin study that came out at the end of 2010 that looked at the real reasons that people go to church, and they came up with some fantastic stuff. Essentially, they came up with a very strong conclusion that the social connectedness is the main, the overpowering reason that people go to church. And one of the reasons they discovered this is that, you know, the whole thing about churchgoers are happier than non-churchgoers. That's this thing that's been claimed many times in various surveys. But they did a little more nuance, and they discovered that churchgoers who have friends in the congregation are happiest. The next level of happiness is non-churchgoers. And the lowest level of life satisfaction is churchgoers with no friends in the congregation. Hmm. So they are actually at the bottom of the pile. Because imagine what that would be like to go once a week to this community and see all these other people connecting and knowing other people and all that, and there you are alone with nobody to connect. It'd be worse than staying home.
Kind of rubbing your nose in it.
Exactly. So for people who want that, for people who need that social connectedness, some sort of non-theistic equivalent is fantastic to be able to have that option. The best I've ever seen are ethical societies, which exist primarily in the northeastern United States. There are some others scattered throughout the United States. It was founded as a philosophical movement. It was not a religious movement at first, and their motto is deed before creed. And that kind of thing and the experiments that are going on all over the place, I just think that's an important piece of the puzzle. And not everybody's going to want to do it. I don't see myself doing it. But to have that as an option, I think, is one of the last remaining pieces in creating a world, creating a real cohesive alternative for people.
Actually, I find it almost ironic in the sense that it's almost like both sides are moving towards the middle. You mentioned in the book that in Norway that 80% of the population belong to Lutheran Church, yet 72% don't believe in God. And, you know, it's always sort of a classic joke that Anglican ministers are also atheists and communists or some such thing like that. That, you know, that the churches themselves are beginning to run out of believers in their own rank.
Right, it's true, and it's evident on Sunday morning. I mean, with the exception of the mega churches, with the exception of the evangelical churches, everybody else has empty pews. So it's there's definitely a mass exodus, and I feel that it's an emergency situation for us to create alternatives for those people so they don't have to bounce back.
Now, in the U.S., there's been a lot of secular activity from, like, the atheist equality movement to the separation of church and state advocates. What do you think the role is in relation of atheism and religion with regards to politics?
Yeah, there's been a lot of movement. There's been a lot of terrific progress from the atheist side. The Secular Coalition for America is an organization that has, I think, now two full-time paid lobbyists in Washington who are lobbying for secular causes and making our voice heard on legislation that affects secular Americans. So there's been a really positive counterbalance to the effect of the religious right. What's going on right now with in terms of religion is fascinating. It's really very interesting because the religious right and the Tea Party movement in the United States. I don't know if you follow that thing, but it's an ultra right wing nut. Movement within the Republican Party, and they have sort of hijacked that party in a way that is killing them. I mean, it's really dragging them in the wrong direction. And there are a lot of evangelicals in that movement, so it's getting to the point where after about 20 years of more than 20 years, but certainly the 80s and 90s of religion really being a force on the right. It's now becoming, to a certain extent, a liability. And who knows how that's going to play out, but there have been a lot of court decisions recently coming down on the secular side, lots of court decisions. There was just, I think it was yesterday, the U.S. Navy, Naval Academy or the Air Force, I can't remember which one, I think it's the Navy, has a pledge that their cadets take when they are sworn in initially. And it ended with, so help me God. And they yesterday, the court ruled that that is now optional. It wasn't the court that ruled. It was the Naval Academy, I think it was, under pressure from the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. I should read more carefully. But there's been a lot of that lately, a lot of that kind of movement. And, you know, you get the outrage, you know, with people on the right and on the religious side. But it's just a little more consistent that we have at least as many victories as failures politically, which is good.
Yes, no. Up here, we've been quite entertained by the Tea Party and the Michelle Bachmans. And actually, a really scary thought is Ted Cruz's father, if you ever hear some of the things that he says, is quite disturbing.
Oh, yeah, because he's Canadian, isn't he?
Yes. Well, Canadian.
Right. The father is or something. Right.
There's been a growing amount of pushback, though, against, you know, these Asian things. Again, you mentioned the Tea Party, among other things. So is this a sign of a resurgent church or that we've actually starting to become noticed in society?
Well, it really is a defensive reaction. I think it's the second one. It's a good sign. The pushback is a little more shrill and occasionally feeble. I mean, when they pushed back in the 80s, you know, when you had the moral majority movement and that sort of thing, it was a done deal. I mean, legislators would just collapse. But now it's much more even-handed. It's much more of sort of a, you know, there's going to be that that pushback. But it doesn't have the political clout that it once had. So I think it's really a very promising sign. Certainly not a resurgent church. The evangelicals, it's kind of hard to, I keep trying to come up with a good visual for this. The churches are all shrinking in the U.S. Membership is down by millions in the last few years. But the evangelical and fundamentalist slice of the pie is growing. So you've got a pie shrinking and one slice growing as it goes. Okay. So the influence overall, the religious influence, is actually shrinking, but it's becoming more shrill at the same time. It's becoming further to the right. So it's, but I think in general, that pushback is a very good sign that we are making progress.
During the tornado that ripped through, I think it was Joplin, Missouri, there was sort of a famous interview with a victim where CNN's Wolf Blitzer said, do you thank the Lord for your split-second decision? And she sort of replied that she was an atheist. And, of course, there was a sort of awkward pause.
Yeah.
And then this was kind of followed up by accusations that there were not any atheist group to provide aid or support for, I think it was the Oklahoma tornado victims. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's right. And she was also in Oklahoma. This was her name is Rebecca Witzman. Who I've met and is just a wonderful, just a terrific person, a very dedicated activist. And what was your last question? I'm sorry.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were about, you know, this accusations, one, that atheist groups don't provide any aid, and the fact that, you know, it's still somewhat of a stigma to be an atheist.
Oh, yeah. It is still a stigma, and at the same time, it's just about impossible to picture somebody doing what she did 20 years ago. I mean, I think the fact that we're at a point where somebody can, you know, however difficult it is, they can sort of say, you know, well, actually, I'm an atheist, I think is a wonderful thing. What would I say about that? Say one more time. You're asking the question. I get off on these tangents.
Just what's the accusations that atheist groups don't provide any support?
Exactly. Joe Klein in Time Magazine wrote this ridiculous piece. It was actually not a ridiculous piece. It was a wonderful piece, I should say, because it was about former military people who are repurposing their skills in disaster relief and focused on Team Rubicon and all these terrific organizations. But he tossed off this line, this one sentence in there that was completely unnecessary. And he said, you know, there are all these churches out there serving hot meals. And he said, you know, it's funny you don't see any organized groups of secular humanists out there, you know, when a disaster happens. Wonderful. I was so glad he did that because it gave us an opening. It gave us an opportunity to show that we were on site in that exact disaster. The organization that I run was only one of many that were active in the Oklahoma City tornado situation. We raised $45,000 for tornado relief. We gave $20,000 to the Oklahoma Regional Food Bank that put 100,000 meals in the hands of tornado survivors in the weeks after the storm. And we supported Operation USA, which had various shelter and clothing and supply assistance going. So we were there, and Free OK, which is an atheist organization in Oklahoma, was out volunteering on the site and helping to clear neighborhoods and so on. There were several different organizations. So he really gave us a wonderful opportunity, and I ended up writing a piece for the Washington Post that showed how he is operating on a with blinders on. You know, he wasn't willing to even Google for 3 seconds and find. It was extremely easy to find out that we were doing this, but he carried his assumption in that we couldn't possibly be doing this, and then made this accusation. So I love things like that. I love an opportunity for somebody to stick their foot in their mouth and for us to say, you know, really quite calmly, that he's full of it. You know, that was quite a nice moment for us.
Well, so besides being an author, you're also the executive director of the Foundation Beyond Beliefs. So what is this group and what does it do besides the meals?
Yeah, Foundation Beyond Belief is a 501c3 charity, which is a U.S. Designation for a charitable organization. And it is a humanist nonprofit. And what we exist for is to focus and encourage humanist and atheist giving. And we have a humanist giving program that features 5 charities each quarter of the year. And members can join the foundation. They can sign up for a membership for as little as $5 a month. And that is a donation going to these charities, and they can distribute any way they'd like among our charities. So we've got 5 different categories. Sometimes somebody will say, okay, I'm going to donate $20 a month, and I want the whole thing to go to the education charity each time. Or I'm going to donate $20, and I want $10 to go to human rights and $10 to go to poverty, the poverty charity. So we have just over 1,500 members now, and we just in July of this year, we crossed $1 million raised for our featured charities. I think now we're up to $1.3 million. We have an annual Light the Night team for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society that has raised at this point over $500,000 for them. We have 80 volunteer teams that are spread in cities across the United States that are volunteering in their communities, humanist volunteer teams. And then we have this crisis response program. We also have just started a program, a pilot, for what is eventually going to be a humanist, international humanist service corps. We have 4 young people right now who are traveling around the world doing service projects in a total of 10 locations in 8 countries over the course of a year. And they are building the foundation for what will be a permanent ongoing humanist service corps, essentially a humanist version of the Peace Corps. So Foundation Beyond Belief is just involved in all these different ways trying to focus and encourage humanist compassionate action.
Very good. Sounds like a great, great organization. You've also written about atheism, ethics, and children. What do you say to someone who states that atheists have no moral foundation without a belief in God?
Yeah. Well, the fortunate thing about morality is that there aren't as many unanswered questions about it as we sometimes pretend there are. We actually know how moral development works, and it works as a result primarily of experience. It doesn't come from a book. It doesn't even come from teaching. It comes from children, young children, having experiences with their peers, and they have the experience of being treated fairly and unfairly, and they know how that feels, and they have the ability to develop empathy for someone else who is being treated fairly or unfairly, who's being harmed or not harmed, and they begin to build an ethic based on those experiences. And we, as parents, we can reinforce the lessons in there. We can encourage them in one direction. Most of the actual ethical development is happening in their experience, not in our parental lectures. So this is something that there's been a tremendous amount of good research done on this. And it's a little bit of an ego deflation for parents, you know, because we think, wow, I raised such an ethical child. Well, yeah, you did fine. But the best thing I can do as a parent is not screw them up. That's really the place that a lot of parents end up. They take these social experiences and they end up adding layers of nonsense to push them in the wrong directions or teach them a sort of authoritarian ethic or any one of a number of other ways you can screw kids up. If you let them have experiences, if you let them have these peer interactions, If you help them process them and talk about them, that's what you can do to raise a moral child. It has nothing to do with the Bible. It has nothing to do with Dr. Spock or any other, child-rearing book. Those can be guides. Even the Bible can give you good information along with the bad. But we're fooling ourselves if we really think that that's where the ethics come from. That's not where they come from.
So I guess that leads to the next question, and I guess we've kind of covered this a bit. So you don't really believe we're born atheists, or at least not true atheists. We have to kind of discover our own. Do you think, though, you should try and raise your child as an atheist?
I think it's pretty important not to. I raise my child with no labels, with the intention that they will eventually choose their own. So I had to, and this was something I wasn't sure about early on when my kids were first born. I thought, well, maybe I should raise them as atheists. But I eventually realized that the thing that was most important to me was not the conclusions that I reached, but the way I reached them, the fact that I reached them independently. I reached them on my own. My parents allowed me to do this. We went to church every Sunday. We did the whole sort of nominal Christian thing. But I was never forced to accept particular answers. I was never told in my recollection that I was going to hell. None of that nonsense. But I was encouraged to ask questions and to find the universe really interesting, and to find the question of whether God exists really interesting. And so I asked those questions and found them something worth my attention, and I ended up with a worldview that I am extremely confident in. I'm standing on a foundation, having placed every brick myself instead of receiving answers from somebody else. And as a result, I know what I'm standing on. I want that same thing for my kids. I want them to discover the world, find it fascinating, be curious about it, and discover it with no restrictions. And then they will put that together into the worldview that they find appropriate. And I would be very surprised if they don't end up with a secular worldview. But if they don't, I'm pretty confident that it's going to be a very progressive religious worldview if they did choose one, one that would match the excellent values that they have.
So instead of raising good atheist children, you want to raise them to be good skeptics?
Yeah, good skeptics and good free thinkers. I'm willing to use the word free thinker with a lowercase f, that this is somebody who is not bound by dogma, doctrine, or authority. They're thinking independently. That is exactly what I want my kids to have. And I don't even want them putting labels on themselves when they're 6 years old or 7 years old. I want them to wait until, 10, 11, 12, if they want to start experimenting with labels, perfectly fine. But up to that point, I want to create space around them.
Another troubling aspect of a lot of government leaders lately is the use of theology to deny science, and not your sort of classic denial of evolution, but sort of using biblical prophecy to dismiss the idea of something like climate change. I'm kind of curious to know what your views are about this particular, they will call themselves skeptics, but not skeptics in the same sense that we've just used a few seconds ago.
Yeah, they can call themselves whatever they want, but it's a non-starter. That is something that has to be opposed vigorously because it really matters. So what you do in that case is science education for public policymakers. You want your representatives to know what science is and what it isn't, and that only science belongs in the science classroom. Only science belongs in, only the input of the scientific community matters in matters of, science-based public policy. It's getting to that understanding that is going to make the difference in a lot of these things. And the clock is ticking on something like climate change. This is not messing around. This is, as much as I love evolution, I was an evolutionary anthropology major in college, and I absolutely adore it. And climate change is more important. If I had a choice between getting religion out of the evolution debate and getting it out of the climate change debate, I would absolutely choose to get it out of the climate change debate, because that's going to kill us. That's going to be the other one is simply robbing our reality of an awful lot of its poetry and wonder and truth. But this other one is about saving the planet. I think it's essential. And the way to do it is to go right at the root of the problem and say, you need to understand what science is and why it is that we can have tremendous confidence when 99% of the scientific community agrees on something. We can have tremendous confidence in that.
Well, thank you for taking time to join us. Is there any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I'd just encourage everybody to check out Foundation Beyond Belief if they're interested in that. We're at foundationbeyondbelief.org, and you can sign up again as a member for as little as $5 US a month. and you can quit at any time. There's no, you don't have to sign up for any particular length of time. I should also say that we are just about to launch in 2014. We're going to launch FBB Australia at the beginning of the year, and FBB Canada is set to launch around the middle of 2014.
Well, that sounds exciting. Maybe we can have you or the leader, the head of that Colin show when it launches.
That'd be great, yeah.
Well, thanks, and we will return after this commercial break.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
Well, it's time to say goodbye. I want to remind our listeners to be the candle in the dark. Yes, it's that time again for Skepticap Vancouver, a fun, informative, attendee-driven conference featuring brief presentations on skeptical and scientific topics. It's happening this Sunday, November 3rd, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's going to be at Buchanan Room A102. That's 1866 Main Mall in UBC Vancouver, right here at the UBC campus. It's free. You can register at vancouver.skepticamp.org. Yours truly will be delivering a talk entitled 1984, Snowden, the NSA, and Spying, a Skeptical Look at the Surveillance State. The title was inspired by the fact that after the Snowden revelations, the sale of the book 1984, George Orwell's dystopian tale of the surveillance state, rose by over 4,000%. I thought I would take a skeptical look at the state of the surveillance state. How much should we fear the boot of Big Brother smashing on the face of humanity forever? Well, anyhow, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The cosmos is full.